Hi, friends.
Hello, should I delete that, listeners?
We still have some tickets left for our live tour and we would absolutely love to see you there.
On Thursday, the 23rd of May, we will be performing in the London Islington Assembly Hall.
On Monday, the 27th of May, we will be in Salford.
On Tuesday, the 28th of May, we'll be in Glasgow.
Sunday, the 2nd of June, Birmingham.
Monday, the 3rd of June, Bristol.
And Tuesday, the 4th of June in Southampton.
You can get your tickets at aegpresents.co.uk or via the link in the show notes or our Instagram bios.
We really hope we see you there.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, people underestimate the level of deception that goes on. And I mean, I used to say to my teachers, oh, well, I've got a doctor's appointment. You know, I'm off at 10 to 1. And I'd sneak off and I would run around Regent's Park 3 times. And then I could get my friends to open the fire escape for me to sneak back into school.
Hidely Hurdly, welcome back to Should I Delete That? I'm Em Clarkson and I am alone today. Sounds tragic. It sounds really tragic when you say it like that. I didn't count on it. I'm trying to do the empowering thing. I can take myself out for lunch. I can buy myself flowers, you know what I mean? But it just sounds sad. I am alone today. And we've got an amazing interview and I'm just gonna let us get on with it. I'll whiz through my own week, just in case anybody cares. If you don't, no drama. You know what? I think I've been a top class citizen this week. I don't even think I have a single awkward for the group. Got a couple of goods. I ran a half marathon last weekend. PB time. Record. God, that feels like a long time ago. But on Sunday, I went and ran a half marathon. The second one that I've done since having a baby. And it was 13 months and 8 months are very different stories postpartum. If you are thinking about getting back into running after having a baby, can I just recommend you just take a beat? Slow down. With hindsight, 8 months was way too soon. And the proof was in the pudding because the second one I ran was 45 minutes faster. And I think that's just indicative of like everything. And that brings me on to my other good, probably bad and awkward, all bundled up into one. And that's the fact that I've given up breastfeeding. I've stopped breastfeeding this week and I'm an absolute mess, which is truthfully why I'm here alone, not because I've pushed away all my friends and they all hate me because I'm a hormonal disaster and no one will talk to me anymore, although that could be it. Now I'll sit anxiously spiraling that could be the case. Unlikely, I hope. I don't know. Genuinely, I'm a mess. I'm all over the place emotionally. I'm up and down. I'm so chaotic, so anxious, so tired. I've left everything so last minute and it's all just chaos. And I feel like no one talks about this. Everyone talks about like getting you into breastfeeding, like how to maintain breastfeeding. Yay, breastfeeding. But when it comes to stopping, everyone's just like, haha, figure that one out. You got jugs full of milk and it's going to hurt like buggery. Good luck. Don't get mastitis, by the way, because that's awful. And then that's just kind of the feedback from Google. So it's been intense and I didn't anticipate the hormone drop. I've actually read a lot subsequently and spoken to a lot of people about how like people thought they were getting late set postnatal depression, about the links between like so much of the like delayed hormone drops from pregnancy kind of carry on until when you stop breastfeeding. I don't know. Obviously not a doctor, but I am. I tell you what, I am. I'm not a doctor, but I'm a mess. So I'm really hoping to like level out soon. Watch this space. Which is why you could probably just do with less of me today. Just less of me. So without further ado, I'm going to let us get into the interview. We spoke with Pandora Morris today and we're going to put a big trigger warning on the conversation, on the whole episode, really, because we spoke at length about mental health, about OCD, about eating disorders. And it was incredible of Pandora to share her story. She's been through so much and what she's doing by having this conversation, I think will be helping so many people. We're leaving all of her details in the show notes. Pandora doesn't actually use social media at all, which was such an interesting thing to talk to her about, as it just felt so alien, particularly to Alex and I, obviously, who are just glued to our devices. But she does have her own podcast. If you'd like to check her out, there is details to that in the show notes. Without further ado, here is Pandora.
Hi, Pandora. Thank you so much for joining us today. Exciting to be here in the studio. How are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm very honoured to be here in front of you two beautiful blonde girls.
Oh, that's such high
praise. I don't know what to do with myself. Excuse me while I blush.
Blushing. No, we're really excited to have you in. We've got a lot to talk about. And I guess a big part of that is your journey, your long journey with mental health, which has culminated in you having a podcast called Hurt to Healing, which is brilliant. You've had some amazing guests on as well. But I wondered if we could go back to the beginning and if you could tell us your story in your own words.
Yeah, I can start from the very beginning. So I was one of those very anxious children. I remember when I was about four, so constantly checking the locks on the doors. And at night, I would be paranoid that there would be someone in my bed or someone in my wardrobe. And I had a mum who was sort of the absolute opposite. She would leave the doors unlocked, open at night. And I think
I've got one of those mums.
You have one of those mums, yeah, exactly. Really. It's very like, no, nothing will ever happen to me. Like, don't worry about
it. These similar mums know each other.
Yeah,
they must be cut from the same cloth. Exactly. Yeah. And I just, you know, I took it upon myself basically to be the parent in the relationship, I think. And slowly over the years, I noticed that I just always had that slight feeling of being an imposter in friendships at school. I was always second guessing myself, always thinking, God, does anyone like me? I'm not good enough. Always needing to achieve. And then I guess the first signs of the OCD really sort of escalating came when I went to boarding school when I was eight and I started praying. And the praying sort of started, you know, just three prayers a night, and then within a few months it was sort of six prayers a night, and then I had to do every prayer 18 times, like a very specific number of times, and I'd have to cover every single person in my family, every friend, otherwise if anything bad happened it would all be my responsibility. And at the time no one really knew about OCD. I had absolutely no idea about mental health, anxiety, OCD, and basically thought that it was just normal and that was sort of what I did and it was my coping strategy. And then when I was about 11, I had just a complete breakdown at school. I think everything just got very overwhelming and I had this supposedly unexplained breakdown, and so couldn't stop crying, was having multiple panic attacks a day. The praying was stopping me from sleeping because I was having to do it for hours and hours. It was taking me about 3.5 to 4 hours every night. And anyway, I was, sort of long story short, I was basically pulled out of school at age 12 because I sort of tried to carry on, tried to become a day girl, and it just didn't work. And then, yeah, I sort of had a break for a month and then started at day school in London. And that's when I think I had this sort of serious separation anxiety from my mum. And every day on the way to school, I would be in floods of tears. I just didn't want to leave her side. So I think there was a lot of codependency going on. And again, because I'd been sent to boarding school at such a young age, I don't think I'd had time to form that relationship with her and didn't feel that I was really loved by my mum. And as a result, I think the OCD had crept in as a way of me creating certainty in what I felt was a very unsafe world. It was a way of me finding something that made me feel just like I had a semblance of control. And yeah, anyway, so OCD is one of those things that takes many, many different guises and forms, and it can latch onto anything. And so over the years, it's changed. So the praying was replaced then by the number six. And I had this absolute fear of the number six. I associated it with the devil. And so actually looking back, it's really weird. It was sort of quite religious, my OCD to start with, which reading a lot of literature about OCD, it often does sort of manifest itself in. And then, yeah, so I couldn't do anything to do with the number six. So by the age of 12, I was not being able to write down the number six. I couldn't get into a car if there was six in the registration plate. I couldn't go into a house which had a six on the door, or even if the number was 51, 24, 42. I couldn't, I mean, I would consciously, basically, I would mess up answers in my maths homework because I couldn't write down six. And so it was starting to like actually have quite an impact on life. My mum went to our GP when she started noticing that obviously things weren't quite right. And she said, I think my daughter might have this thing called OCD. And the GP just turned around and said, what's OCD? And the only help that was really available back then was to go either to like the NHS and to go and look around a psych ward for my mum. And as a parent who's already been through what we had been through with boarding school and pulling me out and having all that sort of trauma, basically, and having a child that couldn't sleep alone at night for, I mean, for 2.5 years, I was sleeping on my mum's bedroom floor. I wouldn't go and stay with a friend. I literally wouldn't leave her side. I think she thought, I can't send my daughter to a psych ward. And you know, she went to look around our local NHS one, and she just thought, you know, I just can't do it. And then, yeah, so I started seeing a psychiatrist when I was pulled out of boarding school. I mean, you know, I've been on a 20-year journey with it, and I've seen some of the quote-unquote best doctors around the world, and I've been very, very privileged and lucky to have been able to. But it's unbelievable the level of misunderstanding that surrounds a condition, particularly like OCD. And it's sort of, I had a comorbidity of anorexia as well, so that didn't really help with the clarity of what my diagnosis was. But yeah, so then the number six then morphed into this desire to be a perfect person. You know, all these sort of traits that I associated with being successful and lovable and likable, and then over time it then internalizes. So there are a lot of internal rituals that you have to do, a lot of sequences you have to imagine in your head. And it then became very much about right and wrong. And so everyone I saw, I would categorize into either being right or wrong. And if they were wrong, I mean, there was a sphere that I would literally morph into them. So anyone who was homeless, anyone who sort of was like a drug addict, or people who we associate in society typically as being people that we don't aspire to be like or live like. I literally went into this sort of like panic mode, and I wouldn't be able to walk down the street with my, I sort of put my hands over my eyes. And so I had sort of blinkers on, and life became very complicated very quickly because it took up so much time. And so every time, for example, before school that I was getting dressed, I would have to imagine the right people every time I put on a piece of clothing, and they had to be in the right sequence and the right order. And if a wrong person came into my head, which obviously when your mind's trying to avoid something, it's what you imagine. It's like the pink elephant in the room, right? Someone says, don't imagine an elephant, and the first thing you think of is an elephant. So everything took forever. So getting dressed for school was taking 3 to 4 hours. And then slowly it's sort of, you know, the anorexia as well had an impact on it, because it all became about exercise as well and restricting my food. And so I had this very punitive regime and became very, very obsessed with running. And it's always like a chicken and egg situation. It's like, was it driven by the anorexia or the OCD? But by the age of 14, I was running multiple times a day. And I mean, we clocked up, I mean, with the doctor, that I was running between about 21 and 25 miles every day.
Oh my God.
And yeah, so things went south pretty quickly.
What did you have the time?
Well, yeah, good question. I used to get up very, very early before school. I used to go running around the park, and then I used to pretend to my mum that I was getting the tube to school, and I'd run to school in my school uniform and with my sort of rucksack thudding at the bottom of my back with all my textbooks in it, so that I got sort of horrible sores. And then at lunchtime, I was at this very small school that I managed to convince. I mean, people with mental health issues is what people, I mean, people underestimate the level of deception that goes on. And I mean, I used to say to my teachers, oh, well, I've got a doctor's appointment. You know, I'm off at 10 to 1 when the school bell goes for lunch break. And I'd sneak off and I'd run around Regent's Park 3 times. And then I would get my friends to open the fire escape for me to sneak back into school. And then I'd run home from school, and then I would go, I would pretend that I was doing my homework in my room, and I would sneak out of the back door. And then if my parents went out in the evenings, I would then be able to sneak out again for a sort of a run. And, you know, it's amazing how one just, again, it's driven by this absolute fear of like, if I don't do it, some disaster's going to happen. And I was an addict. I was really in the throes of an addiction.
And did you think that something bad was going to happen to you or to the people that you, was it still, because at the beginning it was like you had to protect everybody around you and pray for them. Was it still that you thought something bad would befall them, or was it about you becoming, you didn't want to morph into, was it more inward or outward at
this
point?
It became then more about me. Yeah. And so I also had so much self-hatred, because I was I'm such an empath, and I was sort of always thinking, God, you know, I hope they like me, or God, I'm such a sponge for their feelings. And I could tell that my actions were A, having such an effect on my family, because yeah, my mum was at her wit's end. She just didn't know what to do with this child that was just literally out of control. And yet I was sort of somehow performing at school. So it was just a very weird juxtaposition of, yeah, she's doing okay, and she seems to be, you know, passing her exams and showing up to lessons. And yet I was, yeah, really in the grips of this, I mean, these demons, and it had, I felt so selfish. And that's the other thing about anorexia, is that I think people often think it's about getting thin, and it's people often say, oh God, you know, it's just such a selfish disease, and particularly my mum's family, you know, oh God, you just need to pull yourself together and eat a plate of food. I mean, what's the problem? Like, here it is, you're so lucky to be able to eat. There are people in the world who can't even afford to have a meal. And so immediately that makes you feel even worse. But it becomes this a vicious cycle of thinking, you know, I've got to eat either less than yesterday or the same as yesterday. I've got to exercise more than yesterday, or again, the same as yesterday. And if you don't do it, your body goes into this. Yeah, it goes into that sort of survival mode where you just feel crippled by the anxiety. So it was just a matter of like literally climbing Everest every day and getting through it, and as best I could, whilst also doing all the rituals and doing the things that I thought I needed to do in order to just cope, really.
It sounds so exhausting. It sounds so exhausting. And it must have narrowed your life so much, because you're having to fit in all of these rituals, all of these sequences.
Mm.
Can I ask, I don't want to jump around, but I want to ask, when your mum took you to try and get some help, and then they offered the psych ward, and your mum decided that didn't feel right. Was there anything in between that and no help? Was there offer of therapy or?
No. So for the NHS, this is what I also speak about quite a lot on my podcast. It's really terrifying that when you're diagnosed with an eating disorder, unless you are literally at a weight or a BMI where you're skeletal and you need to go on a drip, there is very, very little on offer. And of course, that also makes you think I'm not bad enough, because I need to get skinny in order to deserve the help or the. So I think that's something that really needs to be rectified just in our society. But I mean, the only other option was to really go private, yeah, and to see a therapist that was funded and by my parents, which I was very, very lucky that they could afford. And yeah, so I sort of would see a therapist for maybe a year, maybe a year and a half. And would always have a psychiatrist in the background, because I was put on medication. So I was put on SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which, you know, typically involve that people know more about now. But again, then I was very, very young. I was 12 when I was first put on them. And when psychiatrists don't see results after, say, 6 months to a year, they'll be like, oh, well, maybe we should add something. So at one point I was sort of taking three different medications, and there was an antipsychotic in there, then there was more of like a sedative, there was an anti-anxiety thing. And I mean, honestly, I felt like I was just this sort of lab rat, essentially. And I never really noticed a marked difference in my mental health by being put on these drugs. The only thing was the horrible side effects that they often have, and also just feeling like very emotional, like no ability to laugh or cry, and just feeling very like you're sort of flatlining, essentially. So yeah, I mean, I went and saw a therapist, and typically, like when they don't, again with therapists, when they don't get the results they want, they sort of say, well, the good ones actually should say, okay, I'm not sure that this is working. Like, I think, you know, maybe we should think about, you know, doing a different form of therapy. Or, but again, it was 20 years ago, and in those days, I was so ignorant as to what different types of therapy meant. I didn't even know what type of therapy my therapist was practicing. I just thought, I'm going to an adolescent therapist. So did my mom. They say that they, you know, specialize in OCD and eating disorders, and they come recommended from, you know, a couple of family friends maybe, and from a psychiatrist. They must be reputable and good. And yet, yeah, I got to the stage where I don't think I mean, it sounds really awful to say, but I don't think I ever really got the help I needed, all the proper help, until 2021, which was I mean, when looking back, just the amount of time wasted and money wasted, which sounds awful, but that was the reality, really.
And that is probably the reality for a lot of people as well. It's not a one trick fix. And that's why I think it is so important that you do, and I guess that's the name of your podcast, but I think we very often, like, we want to hear these stories from people who are like, or in our minds, we want to hear it from people who are like totally healed and that's all gone from them. And it's not, it's something that they can talk about completely retrospectively. But actually, it's really important that we recognize that as humans, like, we're all trying and evolving. And I think it's really powerful that you can be honest about the fact that it did take so long, despite the fact that you had access to a lot of help and it just wasn't the right help for you. I think, like, that's a really valuable thing to talk about, because I don't think we talk about that a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was really, as you so rightly say, that was really the incentive for starting my podcast, is because I found them so incredibly helpful in hearing other people's stories and their journeys, but also quite alienating, because I was there particularly during lockdown, and I was like, oh my God, I've got to an age now where I, quote unquote, should be better. You know, I have parents who are telling me, well, we've taken you to some of the best doctors we can, like, but what's wrong? Like, why, you know, why are you any different from anyone else? Of course, you hear those words, and again, it just fuels that feeling of, oh well, I'm a failure, I might as well be put on the rubbish heap. And you just think, why am I different to anyone else? Is my brain, like, so fucked up that, you know, I can't get this, I'm not going to be able to rewire it? And then I think realizing that actually it was a case of real baby steps, and these changes just take so long to make, and actually it's rewiring years and years of learnt behavior. I think the typical person with OCD takes 10 years to seek help, by which time so much of the habits and the mindset is just so ingrained. And I was thinking this morning, actually, and I was sort of thinking about doing this podcast, this interview, and you know, with OCD, that what you're doing is irrational, so you're not psychotic, which almost makes it so even more incredibly painful, because you're like, well, I can see that this doesn't apply to Emily or Alex, and yet my brain has convinced me that actually I have to do all these rituals and these compulsions around, you know, imagining people and not doing new things, or like avoiding social media, like all these things that I have and I still have to work on a daily basis. But you can't, like, flick a switch and you can't just snap out of it, which would be ideal. No medication, no pill is going to enable you to just wake up one morning and be like, oh, I don't have OCD anymore. Great. It is a matter of having to go through those tiny, tiny baby steps, which is, and it's stacking. It's just, it takes years and years of hard work, which is why so many people just are like, well, maybe I'm just going to have to live like this. And you see people's lives become narrower and narrower and narrower with OCD, as you rightly identify, which is what's happened to me over the years, because you just can't cope. You can't cope with change. You can't cope with anything that deviates from your absolute rigidity of thought pattern. And it is exhausting. It's like, and I sort of liken it to having a second brain, because you can sort of do things at like maybe a 40% capacity. But I sometimes wonder, I like look back on my years at sort of school and university and in my 20s, and I think, God, what would I have done had I not had OCD? And like, what could I have done? And like, what... Yeah. And the trouble is, you can't look back, can you? And we've all got what we've got. And actually, in a way now, I try and say, okay, well, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if I hadn't had the struggles that I have or have had. But, you know, I wanted to be that person that said to people, it's okay to be open about your struggles, because how much worse can things be by actually, I mean, you just shut yourself off and you assume people know. And I think when I started the podcast, so many of my friends said, God, I had no idea. And I thought, well, God, wasn't it so obvious? Like, I spoke about it. I explained to you about, you know, the right and the wrong. I explained to you about new things. And, you know, people are very self-absorbed. Like, as human beings, we are just all, you know, we're all trying to survive the best we can, right? And we all have sort of issues, and we all have daily troubles and anxieties. And a lot of people have mental health issues. And I think the podcast was something that I really wanted to do, to say to people, here I am, and like looking at me and talking to me in a very isolated context, you'd think, oh, well, what's wrong? Like, she's functioning, she's fine. Yeah. She might be a bit crazy about her exercise, and she might be a bit, you know, particular about her food, and she might, but I got to a point where, you know, quote unquote, I looked okay. And like, everyone was saying, oh, well, you've clearly recovered from anorexia. And you're just, again, that is like, It's like the worst thing that you can say to people. The naivety surrounding what you should and shouldn't say to people who have had eating disorders, and as I'm sure you guys are very cognizant of. But honestly, it baffles me. And then with the OCD, that's not really something that's understood. So I get comments chucked at me all the time being like, oh, what, so are you just really neat and tidy? Or, oh, do you have to sort of, you know, do things in a particular order? Or yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can you not step on the cracks on the pavement? And you're just like, oh my God, like, do I even get started? And I think for me, it was also out of the frustration of being so misunderstood for so many years. And I just wanted to be the person that tried to create that open dialogue and do something that would hopefully, yeah, help other people.
Something that struck me, sorry I keep jumping around, but I've never thought about OCD like that, but there's a particular cruelty in the fact that you're not psychotic, you have a grip on reality, and you can identify that what you're doing isn't rational, and applied to someone else, it wouldn't be rational. And yet, the discomfort—I don't know. This might be putting words in your mouth, but the discomfort of you not doing what your brain is telling you to do is too high for you not to do it. That must be really difficult. I've never really thought about it like that. I guess there's almost—I mean, I'm not saying like psychosis is better. Obviously, that is not good either. But there is that cruelty and like in knowing. That
the
there's
awareness.
And
it's this bodily sensation, like literally when I get triggered and I have to do an exposure.
I wanted to ask about how you deal with the triggers now.
Good question. It depends how big the trigger is. So for example, I moved house last week. So if you had asked me to move, if you had said to me, you're going to move house 2 years ago, I'd be absolutely, I can't, no way. Like that's a huge new change, a huge new thing. And I could prepare for that. So that was like, the ones I can prepare for are sometimes more painful because I get that anticipatory anxiety and that's kind of almost the worst bit. But once I've done it, you know, I'm sitting here, whereas before I would have had probably 8 months of having to like literally go into a hole of doing all my compulsions, all my routines. Whereas now I know that the only way that I'm going to get better from OCD is by resisting as many compulsions as I can. So at the moment, it's like keeping myself on the straight and narrow, keeping my exercise contained, keeping my food on track, continuing to show up, continuing to do the podcast, doing what I know I want to do to create like a richer and more fulfilled life rather than going into that sort of OCD hole. Before, I would have dealt with triggers by just doing all my compulsions and doing my rituals, imagining the right people, talking about the right people, going for days and days of just like, you know, having to converse with right people, having to exercise in a very rigid, specific way. So for sort of typically between like 5 and 7 hours a day, being very rigid about my food, not being able to go to a restaurant, not being able to let anyone else cook for me, like literally being super controlled and like not really seeing anyone sort of on a social basis because I was just so either so exhausted or just so sort of like literally militant about my routine. Whereas now I really, so I'll get that panic. So say, I'll give you an example because it's probably easier to explain. So say you've handed me a phone and it was on Instagram. I have never been on Instagram. I find like 2 years ago, I couldn't even say the word Instagram. Social media is just a huge source of trigger for me because it's a new thing that, well, it came, it's not new for many, for most people, it's not new at all. But what, the first kind of social media, I guess, was Facebook. But that was what, Facebook was probably 17, 18 years ago that it was, I don't know, anyway, roughly. So I developed a thing because it was a new thing that I never did. So the longer you leave anything, it's like anyone who has an issue with, I liken it to like if you have a pile of emails, they sort of, you don't read one and then you get three and then you get 100, you know, and slowly they stack up. So that you just become so overwhelmed that you're like, okay, I can't look at that pile of emails. I want to start a new email account. And I just want to like put, so that, and that's like OCD. So you have these avoidances. So for me with social media, it's something I've avoided. So I avoided doing it in the first instance. And then it's now become this huge thing that I'm just like, oh my God, how do I even start to make inroads into it? So when I had treatment during COVID, one of the focuses was on trying to like delve into this social media thing. And unfortunately, sort of, we didn't do it as thoroughly as we focused on sort of some other of the things that I was doing. But essentially I got handed a phone on Facebook, and like I had to sort of go onto Facebook, and then I got handed a phone with TikTok, but we never did the Instagram. So Instagram's just become this sort of massive source of, yeah, trigger for me. So if you handed me a phone now on Instagram, I would literally, my whole body, I would feel that sort of panic, and it would be that like, oh my God, I'm literally about to be eaten by an animal alive, and the worst thing is just about to happen, and the world's about to implode. Now I know that that's going to be the immediate reaction, and like, okay, then like breathe, and this, so it's like that typical anxiety curve. It will sort of peak, and then it will slowly, slowly over time subside. I've got a very good therapist now who I can WhatsApp, which really helps me. So externalizing it and talking about it. So if you handed me a phone, it would be like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. And if I was in a safe enough space with people who I trusted, I could be like, okay, this is, I've been really triggered. I've got to breathe. I know what I've got to do. The temptation is to then give into the compulsions. So for me, it would be internally imagining the right people, talking about the right people, then going off on like a walk or going to do some exercise, and then spending days sort of doing this, sort of the thing that I've just spoken to you about. So everything has to be very rigid. Whereas to beat it and to not strengthen the OCD, I have to do the opposite to what it wants. And this is the tricky thing with OCD, right? It's one of those very self-perpetuating illnesses, because it will, if you give into the compulsion and what it wants you to do, momentarily you get this huge relief and you're like, oh. So if you handed me the phone with the Instagram, although that in itself would be a sort of huge source of anxiety, and for weeks and weeks and weeks it would be in the back of my mind, if I resisted the compulsions for a couple of days, it would start to weaken the OCD. If I gave into the compulsions, it would give me that momentary relief and like, okay, I'm in control, I'm safe, like the world's okay, like nothing, you know, nothing bad's going to happen. But in doing so, it strengthens the OCD. So it's like this constant cycle that you're in. And when you're young, of course, in your teens, you just think, well, I'm going to do anything I can to just feel okay. And so anything to avoid the anxiety and that horrid feeling, you'll do. And unfortunately, that's what just makes the muscle grow and grow and grow until your brain literally feels like it's encased in this ivy that is just, I mean, unpenetratable, if that's a word. But it just, yeah, you can't penetrate it. And it's really, really hard to make inroads, which is why therapists find it so hard to treat, and which is why so often when OCD exists as a comorbidity, so alongside anorexia, alongside addiction, that seems to be the primary focus. And that's what I found talking to a lot of people. There are very, very few therapists who really specialize in exposure therapy. It's become more of a thing in the last few years, but really intensive exposure therapy for OCD, which needs to be done on a daily basis when it's really, really bad. And you have to also learn to do the exposures on your own, which takes a huge leap of faith, right? To sort of suddenly start facing your fears repeatedly. Because the trouble is, if you do one thing one day, you've got to keep doing it every single day to like immunize yourself against it, as it were. So it would be fine to go on social media one day, but if you don't do it for a prolonged period, it just becomes, it resets very quickly and becomes a phobia again.
Is that something that you want to, or is a long-term goal for yourself, would be to do the exposure therapy with Instagram, for example?
Yeah, exactly. So funny enough, I was talking today about it, and it's like, so with my therapist, so the goal at the moment is, so if anyone sends me a screenshot of anything from Instagram, I immediately, I go into this panic, I exit the message, and I can't respond to the message until they send me another message of writing. So I'm not directly responding under that picture, because goes into all these irrational, and I won't try and like rationalize it because it's not rational, but my OCD will rationalize it. So the first thing we're now working on is, if someone sends me a screenshot, it's like I have to look at it for, I have to just sit with it for 10 seconds and then I can exit. So you slowly start, you sort of build up to doing. So what I've done in the past is it's just I've done with a bang. It's like, okay, right, I'll just go on to, so well, I haven't done the social media, but I'll just, I mean, do a big new thing, like move house, and then just sit with it. Whereas actually what's the best way of doing it is this, okay, you look at pictures of a thing, you draw it, you write about it, you and you would slowly get your mind into that space of, okay, I'm, and you almost, yeah, in doing it gradually, then when it comes to the sort of big event, it's like, oh, well, it's not such a thing anymore. So I've actually kind of mentally prepared for it.
Built the scaffolding.
Exactly.
So when you said before that, like the comorbidities, Did you find that psychiatrists and therapists were more interested in treating your anorexia than your OCD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Whereas actually, and do you believe that the anorexia was a result? I mean, it's they're so linked, aren't they? But was a result of the OCD?
I think they both exist in like sort of slight, I think there's overlap, but I think you have to see them in slightly separate spheres. And I think with eating disorders, they morph and they evolve over time. So the anorexia then became more orthorexic, which then for a period became more like binging and restricting. And then I realized that actually it was kind of bulimia because I was using the exercise as really my purging tool. And then it sort of becomes just very rigid ways of eating, and it's disordered eating, whereas the OCD definitely existed in a realm of its own because of things with like the praying and the numbers and the right and the wrong, like that was very much a thing. But then of course it did also feed into the food because the food was part of the compulsion, as it were. So when I did an exposure, like the need was to like go into the controlling of the food. So yeah, I think they both exist separately, and that was actually when I was in treatment during COVID, that was one thing that was actually quite refreshing, because every doctor sort of always used to spend so much time like, well, I'm not sure whether your primary or your secondary is, you know, anorexia or OCD. And when I went in my early 20s into treatment for the anorexia, they refused to even acknowledge that I had OCD. It was like complete denial. No, you don't need any separate treatment from the other girls. You're just the same. Everyone with anorexia or an eating disorder has a bit of OCD. And I said, yeah, I understand that, but my OCD is sort of slightly in a different category. And I know that from such a young age, the compulsions have taken up. I mean, they do these sort of different tests to quantify like how bad you are on the scale of OCD. And when I spoke to this doctor in America, she just said to me, I don't know how you're still alive. Like literally you're just coming, your test scores are just, you know, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. And you're spending, literally you dream in OCD. So I mean, every hour of every day, not even every waking hour, every sleeping hour. I mean, honestly, it's something that I think, again, people just don't realize quite how paralyzing it is. And as you said, because you're so aware of what you're doing, it's almost like you're just like, what, why? The frustration,
you feel the responsibility.
Yeah, of course.
You said it was in 2021 that things took a turn and you feel like you finally got the help that you needed, despite having lots of help previously. What happened in 2021? Who was it that you saw? So
I was very lucky. I was actually on the wait list for a place called Adru, which is in Kent, in Beckenham. And that's the anxiety disorder residential unit. And a guy called Professor Beale heads up the unit for OCD. And I found him in 2020. And it's so ironic because you would have thought that by seeing some of the best, quote unquote, best psychiatrists in London, they would direct you to the top guy on OCD. And me and my mum were slightly also flummoxed because you also feel slightly responsible. Why the hell hadn't we found this guy before? Anyway, I had an appointment with him at the Priory and he said to me, you're not going to get anywhere treating this as an outpatient. You really need to go inpatient to treat the OCD. Anyway, so I went to look around Adru in the autumn of, so this was in the autumn of 2019. And I put myself on the wait list. I really, really didn't want to go because my experience of inpatient treatment in my early 20s had been just so horrendous and had really re-traumatized me. And I think it probably set me back quite a few steps. Anyway, I trusted this guy and he was the first doctor that I'd seen that really just understood the language of OCD and just totally got it within an hour. He was just, you can just tell. And anyway, so I had my name on the wait list and then 6 months passed. And by that time it was kind of Christmas, still hadn't heard. So contacted them, what's happening? Oh, you're on the wait list. Don't worry, you'll get a space soon. Mm. And then lockdown happened in March and I still hadn't got a place. And anyway, contacted them and they said, we're really sorry, we've had to close the unit indefinitely. And we suggest you get a copy of the Compassionate Mind workbook and continue with your therapist on Zoom. And I thought at that point, so I had been a lawyer, turbulent career as a lawyer during my 20s of like periods of being signed off, but I had qualified and I quit a year before lockdown and thinking, okay, I'm now going to really focus on my mental health because to me, getting that qualification was such a, I don't know, it was almost like a bit of a fuck you to my OCD. It was like, I'm going to qualify as a lawyer at a top legal firm and I'm going to show you that I can do it. And I thought in doing so, as everyone does, it's going to open all these doors and suddenly I'm going to be the person that, you know, has the confidence and whatever, I'm going to take on the world. Anyway, of course, that never happens. And it literally just, if anything, I was at like the lowest point that I'd ever been. Anyway, so when I got this email, my heart just sunk to the floor and the light had completely gone out. And I know for so many people, lockdown was horrendous. And I think for people with mental health issues, it was particularly hard because, you know, every day looked the same, the depression, the onset of anxiety, just everything that went with it. Mm. And when I got the email, I just thought, this is it. I can't go on. That was my lifeline. And I'd been holding out, surviving for that point at which I would go into ADRA and hopefully get the help and the tools that I so desperately craved. And there's this inner streak of determination, which I think a lot of people with OCD have, that, you know, I will, there must be something. And I had sort of really survived thinking that I will eventually find something that just flicks that switch in my head. And anyway, so I just went from sort of just really surviving to get to the point where I would be let into ADRU to then the point of just being like, I've given up. Like, just, I don't know what to do now. And I think my mum pretty quickly realised that, like, this was quite serious. I was, yeah, contemplating ending my life and just thinking, the world seems a very bleak, dark place. And I incidentally had lunch with a friend sort of when things started to open up in the summer. And I was just sitting there, not able to eat. And I just, you know, she said, how are you? And I just burst into tears and her family were there. And she had been over to the States when we were in our teens, struggled with an eating disorder. Anyway, she said to me, look, just speak to my psychiatrist who I saw when I was in my teens in America. Because he's kind of like an encyclopedia. And if he can't help, he'll know someone who can. And at this point, no doctors in the UK were really seeing people, especially new patients. And there was definitely no hope of getting into an inpatient residential program, which I knew that I needed at that point. Anyway, so I spoke to this doctor in America. He was very kind. He spoke to me straight away. And he said, we've got to get you out here as quickly as possible because it doesn't sound good. And it sounds pretty critical. He said, I know a woman who can help with the OCD and I can help with the food, but we've got to get you to America. And that was in the summer of 2020, when there was just no hope that I was going to get to America. And we tried getting medical visas and I didn't qualify because, I mean, there were so many loopholes. And then eventually in the autumn, my mum was sort of very, very tenacious and determined as well. And she discovered that there was a loophole where you could go into Mexico and cross the border through Mexico if you spent 2 weeks in Mexico. So anyway, we got a space at this, it was an outpatient treatment center for OCD, and anyway, very near where this other doctor was based. And we found a little flat to rent and we booked our flights. She had a space to see me in January of 2021. And yeah, so we spent a month in Mexico in the end because all the borders started closing in the Christmas of 2020 again. So we hopped on the last flight to Mexico and not knowing whether we were going away for 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And had this horrible month in Mexico where we both like nervous wrecks. And my mum coming up with every contingency plan of like how we're going to cross the border if every flight gets grounded. Oh, we've got to get a car. We've got to like get a we've got to get a plan to then be able to walk across the border. We've got to find contact. I mean, honestly, I was like, who's the anxious one? Like, who's the one with the issues here? Anyway, we arrived. And the doctors immediately looked at my mum. They're like, is she the one with the issues or are you the patient that we're here to see? Anyway. So, and that was where I started my healing journey, I'd say. And that was a case of very invasive and consistent exposure therapy. And I was with a therapist every day, 7 days a week for the first 3 months, seven hours a day, just doing exposure after exposure, after exposure, after exposure. And it was very planned. So as I said before, you know, I started with imagining the exposures that we were going to do. Then I would start writing about them. And then I would start actually having to look at pictures of all the wrong people. Then they would put my face superimposed on pictures of the wrong people. And then we would go out and we'd go out into these sort of, you know, and we were in LA and there's sort of these homeless villages. And so then I was going into the homeless tented sort of villages, as I would call them. And I'd be having to have prolonged interactions. I'd be having to, you know, anyway, do various tasks around that and then doing new things alongside. So everything was sort of jumbled and wrong. And that was we did that for 6 months. And in the end, you know, that sort of was I was very, very lucky, and I feel so blessed to have been able to have had that time. But eventually my mum just said, that's all I can afford to do. And they said, you know, to get real results, you'll have to be here for 2.5 years. And we couldn't do that. So I came back to London. And of course I went back a few steps, but I didn't go down to that baseline that I had left at. And I've slowly rebuilt since there. And it's hard, like, as I say, every day you have to go left when your brain wants to go right quite often, and I have to tackle and conquer the avoidances, which fill me with dread. And it's there like a weight on your shoulders, because if you tackle them, it's just like constant banter at the back of your head. Oh, you shouldn't be doing that. Oh, you should be doing that. Oh, that's messy. Oh no, you've done that. So you're so hyper aware of everything that's going on around you. And you know, I'm at an age, and like, you know, you guys are both mums, and I think, God, the opportunities that I've missed, and the things in life that I've had to forgo, relationships that I haven't had, you know, opportunities I've had to say no to. But you have to just, I guess, yeah, you carry on with what you've got, right? And I'm so lucky to have found the podcast and a forum where I can have these conversations and conversations like this with incredible people and some amazing doctors, and hopefully help people along the way and slowly build my community. And I really hope that listeners of the podcast and of this podcast stick with me, because it's like, it's a patience thing with people with OCD, right? You know, the more comfortable you get and the more that you get into your stride. Mm-hmm. I'm not about to become like a viral sensation or be able to be an influencer, which I wish that for the sake of like the podcast and like the chances of it succeeding, I could do. But I've got to adjust my expectations. And I think you sort of do what you can do in life, don't you? And I think you just hope that things continue to get better.
I imagine that before the podcast you didn't have support or a community within the OCD world. I imagine,
yeah,
and
yeah,
people who experience the same thing as you, the podcast must have opened that up for you. Mm. Which has got to be so helpful and so useful to have connection in that area.
I think it does. I mean, that's the sad thing about not being able to do social media, right? Is that I can't connect yeah. with many of my audience, which is, I hope I'll be able to eventually work towards. And I'd love to be able to do more live Q&As. Yeah. And I think expanding that side of things will really, really help. I was really lucky. And as you said, as I've been more open about it, some people have approached me, and I've got an incredible mentor who actually I worked as a lawyer with, who I speak to every week when it's a tough, twice a week, and he completely understands how my mind works, and it's so refreshing to have someone like that. And as you say, if I hadn't been open about my struggles, and if he hadn't been open about his, we would never have met. And so finding those kindred spirits, it is incredible, and it's really transformative, because you don't even have to explain. And that's the thing that you start to realize, and this is what I was thinking earlier, is that OCD is so illogical in that it can latch onto anything. So he has a thing about confidential papers and them attaching to him. And I have a thing about new things and change and right and wrong. And yet it's all the same. The rationale is all exactly the same. Mm. So we can both have a conversation and completely get the way right. that we're thinking. And yet I can laugh about his, you know, his papers, and he can laugh about my right and wrong people, because it's just so, to me, I'm like, what? Like confidential papers? Like, yeah. What's that about?
And I'm really pleased for you as well that you just got the support eventually that you needed. Like, And that you can kind of take what you learned as well and share it with so many other people, and know that there is help out there, I guess, as well. Because I suppose for a long time it must have felt really hopeless. But to know that there is treatment and that you've benefited from it, and that you're so much better than you were, and that this isn't the end of your journey, that you can keep getting better. Mm. It feels hopeful.
You're so kind. Well, I mean, yeah, someone said to me the other day, well, the next iteration of the podcast needs to be Healing to Living.
Wow.
And it kind of made me smile. I was like, Jesus. But it is true. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm on that, the hurt to healing, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And yeah. Of course, people say to you, oh yeah, well, you know, your biological clock's ticking, and you know, you're going to miss another opportunity. And yet you just can't think like that, because if I go down that rabbit hole, then I'm just going to spend a whole life living in like regret and fear. And this is the whole thing with OCD. It's all about fear. And you realize that what it boils down to is it's just this fear of being and fear of yourself. And you know, fear of what you can be and all of those unknowns and those question marks. And actually, the more that you open yourself up to the universe, which is what I try and do now, I'm sort of the mindset of what will be. So when people say, are you freezing your eggs? Are you doing this? Are you doing that? I'm like, well, I'm actually not, because I slightly believe that what comes into my path will come into my path when it's meant to happen. And I'm, and by being, trying to be more in that abundance mindset, and by trying to just be a bit more spontaneous about life, which obviously goes against every grain in my body, but it's amazing what starts to happen, and things fall into your lap that you never ever thought were possible. And of course things go wrong, and oh my god, I have weeks, and you know, I have very, very dark days, and I find it really hard at this time of year when it's gloomy and gray, and you just wake up and you think, oh my god, you know, I've got a mountain to climb today before. Yeah, for me, I know that like the first half of the day is always really, really challenging. And then after sort of, you know, after say midday, things start to get a bit easier, because at the beginning of the day, I was just hyper anxious. Mm. And if I don't get triggered, then the afternoons can be my time where I feel slightly more relaxed. But, and it's just recognizing those things. And I think being okay with, yeah, doing what you do and just hopefully progressing at the same time, step by step, but knowing that it's okay that you go backwards at times, and knowing that when you have a trigger, it will be fine to take a few steps back or to hibernate for a bit, but those periods become less and less. So if I liken it to the moving house, it would have taken me a year or two to have, like, get to the place where I could deal with that, whereas now it takes me maybe a couple of weeks, and then I'm like, okay, right, back in. So, you know,
that's incredible. You're doing such a good job, and I don't want to be cheesy, but you should be so proud of yourself after everything you've been through to be here now and doing what you're doing. You should be so, so proud of yourself.
Well, thank you guys for taking a gamble and for interviewing me.
Thank you so interesting. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us, Pandora.
We'll leave the link to Heart to Healing in the show notes.
Yes.
If anyone would like to go and listen, please do. Thank you so much, Pandora.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Should I Delete That is part of the Acast Creator Network.